Our time is short, so let me dive right in and tell you in one sentence what is the theme of chapter 3 of the book of Joshua. It can be said simply in one sentence. The Lord brings Israel across the river in the face of their complete helplessness. The Lord brings Israel across the river in the face of their complete helplessness. Now, there are two parts to that, as I think you can see. One is Israel's and ours, our complete, total, utter helplessness. And the second is the Lord brings Israel and us across the river. Let's look at the two of these for just a few moments each. Dive right in. Bear with me. I'm going to move very quickly, but I want you to get a grasp of this whole chapter and then be able to apply it by God's grace and help to your own hearts. Israel's complete helplessness, and ours too. The issue for Joshua and for the people is that will God fail them now that their backs are up against the wall? Or perhaps better, now that their backs are up against the river. Will God come through? Will He come through when the situation is really difficult? When His failing to come through will mean utter disaster for the people? Will He come through when there is no way out for them? There is no other recourse? You know, you and I read Joshua chapter 3, and we already know what's going to happen, don't we? But the Israelites don't, when they live through this. When they're there, they don't know exactly what God is going to do. They don't know what amazing thing is going to happen. And so, to us, it may seem a little ho-hum, but I guarantee you, to the Israelites, it was not ho-hum at all. The Israelites did not know if God was going to come through for them. They did not know how precisely God was going to work out this most difficult of situations. Their helplessness could not have been more apparent to them. Between them and the promised land was a river and a city, both of which are in the way to the fulfillment of what they need, want, and what God promised them. A river and a city. Now, the city we talked about last week in Joshua chapter 2, the story of Rahab. While this may not be the main function of the story of Rahab, one of the things that happens to us in Joshua chapter 2 is that we see something about how big and mean this city is. It is big, it is walled, it is armed, and it is dangerous to the Israelites. And yet we learn from the interaction between the spies and Rahab what? That the people who live in Jericho already know that God is going to defeat them. And therefore, Rahab tells the spies that all the people have their hearts being melted before God. So we know, and the Israelites know by now, that the city will fall. But what about the river? You can't get to the city if you don't get over the river. And we know what's going to happen. But if you read verses 14 through 17 from the point of view of the Israelites, you see how utterly and completely helpless they are. In verse 14, the people set out to pass over the Jordan. The priests are carrying the Ark of the Covenant on ahead of them. In verse 15, and the translations differ here, and I need to help you understand this. In verse 15, it says that the feet of the priests are coming near to the water's edge. But in the Hebrew language in which verse 15 is originally written, there's actually a break. There's a break that doesn't make any sense really in English. In my translation, not the one that you have, but in my translation, it's actually put in the form of a parenthesis. Now the Jordan overflows all its banks throughout all the time of harvest. So they're telling the story. The people are going on. The priests are going on. They're carrying the ark. They come to the edge. And just at the moment when you're waiting for the miracle to happen, there's this climatology break. There's this break in the action to tell you something about the river conditions. Why is that so? Why does that happen? Why would anyone want to ruin a perfectly good story with a report on river conditions? It's because only if you understand how bad the situation is in the river will you understand how great God's mighty power is in what He's about ready to do. It's a little bit like movies on TV. Don't ever watch movies on TV. Really, it's a terrible way to watch a good movie, because just when you get to the climactic moment, the kiss is about ready to happen, and then break. McDonald's. After the first service, a little boy, a guy about 7 or 8 years old, came up to me. He said, "I'm glad there's commercials in those movies where they kiss." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because I don't like kissing." And I said, "Oh, okay." He said, "But I'll tell you one thing, Pastor Ryan. They shouldn't break in with commercials at football games." Just at the moment when you think you know what's going to happen, but the Israelites don't, there's this pause where they tell you the commercial about the river's conditions. And yet that's a very important thing. The condition of the river shows us how much need there is among the people. The Jordan River, you see, runs between what? The Sea of Galilee in the north, south to the Dead Sea. The river valley varies from 3 to 14 miles wide. And within the valley, the floodplain, the river floodplain itself, varies from 200 yards to 1 mile in width. And because it's the early spring, or it's sort of a late spring harvest time, an early harvest time, but probably very late in the spring, what you have now is that the snows on the mountains have melted and the tributaries are flooding the Jordan River so that it has swollen the floodplain, and the river is in fact as wide as it could possibly be at any time of the year, with a depth up to 12 feet. And it drops, furthermore, in elevation from the Sea of Galilee down to the Dead Sea. It drops so severely that sometimes it falls 40 feet per mile. And what does that mean? It means that the river is not a sweet little babbling brook. It is a mighty current, a torrent, a raging river. And to make matters worse, something we often don't know about the Jordan River is that it wasn't a smooth river bottom. The river bottom was filled with weeds and dense bush and jungle-like growth. So that the barrier was huge. It was not only the water, it was not only the depth and the width of the water and the speed of the water, but it was also the things that were in the water that would keep the people from getting across. And this was no little sweet Turtle Creek meandering its way through the community. This was a raging river, a mile wide in all probability at the floodplain, covering a tangled web of vegetation. People could not get across this river without drowning. That's the bottom line. You couldn't do it. I consider myself a good swimmer. I learned how to swim when I was a kid in Long Island Sound. And then when I went to Hurricane Island, Maine, the first summer I spent there with Outward Bound, I had to learn to swim in the raging Arctic Atlantic Ocean. First time I ever jumped in the Atlantic Ocean. I'd grown up in New England, but I didn't know that the warming effect of the Gulf Stream misses Maine. And so the first time I jumped in the Atlantic Ocean was after I'd run 3 miles, and I was just going to jump off the dock into the Atlantic Ocean and think I was going to have a nice leisurely swim. Well, there'd been a storm the previous night, and they were telling us to jump off the dock anyway, and the waves were choppy and going every which way. And I hit the water, and it was a little bit like somebody had gone like this right in my stomach. The water was so cold that you felt rabbit-punched, and all you could do was just frantically dog paddle for the side. There was no way that anyone was going to be able to swim across this river. The situation was simply too dangerous. Why does the Lord have the people crossing the river at the time of the year when the river was at its worst for crossing? Obviously, it is because He wants them to do it at the time when their helplessness is the greatest. Obviously, He wants them to do it at a time when they most know that they are going to be incapable of doing that which they have set out to do. And therefore, they must do it in only the way which the Lord Himself provides. Because the only the way that the Lord Himself provides will be the way of escape. I think it's fair to say that the mark of being a Christian is that you know from time to time that God has hemmed you in, so there is no way to escape except the way that He provides. There is no way out of the difficulties in which you find yourself. Now, this happens to us, dear friends, on a number of different levels in our lives. And I want you to see a couple of these levels at work in your heart all the time. On the one hand, there's the immediate level of a circumstance of your life where you are simply trapped. You know, one of the great privileges of having been your pastor for almost 11 years now is I'm looking at a sea of faces, and I know what's behind some of those faces. It isn't your sweet Sunday school smiles. It's pain, and it's hurt, and it's loss, and it's heartache. And it's situations where God has hemmed you in. And the question is, do we ever get desperate? Do we ever get to the point where we just cry out to God for Him to do what only He can do? In our helplessness, we cannot fix our lives. And so I see some of you who are struggling with someone who is ill. And you are desperately seeking in your life the God's care and blessing upon someone in your life, a loved one who is not well. You know the Lord is going to answer that prayer, but you don't know how. You know either the Lord is going to heal that person or take them home, but you don't know when, and you don't know how, and you don't know in what way the answer is going to come. I look at some of you who are desperate because the economy has just wiped away much of your resources or taken a job away from you. I'm looking at some of you, and this pushes it a little bit deeper to that other level, who aren't so much trapped by health or by financial issues. You're trapped by something going on in your own heart. And the reality is that your heart is filled with threads of and webs of rope that are tying and binding you down. That there's patterns and movements and themes in your life. Themes of sin. Themes of those things where you have rebelled against God and you're still rebelling against Him and you don't know what to do about those things. And you feel helpless in the face of your own sinful predisposition about this or that matter. Do you know why Joshua had the Israelites camp by the river for 3 days? To rub into their face, as it were, their helplessness. For 3 days they had to look at that raging river. For 3 days they had to see that it wasn't just going to calm down after a day or so. For 3 days they had to see that there was going to be no way to get across if God did not act or move. And it is a mark of the Christian's life that you begin to see yourself hemmed in on all kinds of levels. And you begin to cry out to God, "Oh Lord, I need only the answer which You can provide. I need the way across which You will provide." And then a further mark of the Christian who's walking on and getting ready to follow the priests into the riverbed is this, to know that only the way the Lord gives will be the way to get across. And you begin to despair of your own solutions to the problems of your life and ultimately to the biggest problem of your life. The fact that your heart is committed against God. You recognize your helplessness on temporal levels and on the deepest level of your heart, and you recognize that your heart isn't sweet toward God. You recognize that it's a boiling cauldron of rebellion. And you say, "I don't know what to do about it." Helpless people are the most helped. The Lord said in His Word that He came to us when we were at our helpless state in Christ. He loves our helplessness because that is when His glory and the might of His power is displayed. And the Lord loves to show forth the glory of His own splendor and His own power in our lives. Not because He's egotistical and He likes people to think much of Him, but because it is only by thinking much of Him and His power that we will have our lives fit and make sense, and that we will begin to move against the current of the things that stand up against us. How does the Lord show us the way out? How do we see His might and His power leading us in the face of our helplessness? The answer is in the second main issue. First main issue is our helplessness. The second main issue, it is the Lord who brings Israel and us across the river. And he accomplishes this in three ways, this passage tells us. The first is by giving us perspective on our situations. If you read again the first few verses of this chapter, you will see that they're all about the ark. The ark has not appeared yet in Joshua. This is the first time in the book of Joshua that the ark of the covenant, the ark of God's presence, appears. Joshua calls the ark later in verse 11, the ark of the Lord. And he emphasizes that the Lord identifies himself with this rectangular box about the size of a cedar chest. And the ark is the sign of God's presence with his people at the edge of the river. Just as Jesus Christ is the sign of God's presence with us at the edge of our helplessness. The Lord's presence was everything to these people. And his promise to be present is the unfailing promise of the Bible. We've seen that already in Joshua chapters 1 and 2. Without his presence, there is no way out. There is no answer to the raging river. There is no hope of ever getting over to the land of promise. And it is right to say that in the ark, Jesus Christ was leading these Israelites. That it was Jesus providing the way for them across the river. And therefore, it may seem odd that in chapter 4, verse 4 of chapter 3, Joshua commands that there be a distance of 2,000 cubits or 1,000 yards between the people and the ark. But then Joshua explains, in order that you may know the way you should go, for you have not passed this way before. The reason for the distance is so that the people following could keep the ark in sight and have distance in order to see clearly what was happening as the priests carried it into the riverbed. In other words, if the Israelites were crowding up too close to the ark, then only those in front could see. And those in back would not be able to have the perspective they would need to see, to gaze upon the ark, to watch it, to understand that it is the ark that is their triumph. It is the ark it is their way out. It is the ark of the presence of the Lord that they must cling to by the sight of faith. And that is the first thing that you and I must do in our helplessness. We must gaze upon the Lord with eyes of faith. We must hold fast to him. We must set our eyes upon him in his word, as he is revealed to us. And we must not let go of the Lord with our gaze. We must see him and start to disregard all the things around the circumstances of our life and gaze at him. Only when we do that will we begin to make sense of the chaos of the river. Only then will we begin to make sense of the turbulence of our lives. Only then will we begin to make sense of the turbulence of our own hearts, of the raging storm of sin that wells up in our own hearts against the Lord. Only by gazing upon the Lord in faith is the way out. And so that's the first thing that the people are to do. All eyes are to be on the ark, which is a sign of the coming of the Lord Jesus Christ to save his people. This reminds me, you know, of Mark chapter 10, verse 32, where it says, and they were on the road going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was going on ahead of them, and they were amazed, and those who followed were afraid. There should be a certain amount of amazement as we look at the Lord, just as the Israelites undoubtedly had amazement as they looked at the ark. There should be a certain amount of holy fear. Who is this one who goes on ahead of us? I thought he was my buddy. I thought Jesus was my friend. I thought Jesus was in my hip pocket. I thought Jesus would do what I want him to do for me. But look, he's going on ahead. Where is he going? What is he doing? What is the way? I don't know, but I dare not take my eyes off of him, because only with my eyes on him will I know the way myself. So that's the first thing. Gaze upon Christ in faith. See him as the one who is the truest expression of the ark of God's presence in your own life and the only answer to the turbulence of the river. And then second, not only do we need the perspective of some distance, we also need the preparation of consecration. The preparation of consecration. In order to see the Lord bring them across the river in the midst of their pervasive helplessness, the people had to be prepared. Verse 5 says this, "Consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you." In many places in the Old Testament, the people are told to engage in special preparation for some important thing that the Lord is about ready to do. Sometimes they're told to wear certain clothes or to wash their clothes a certain way. Or sometimes they're told to abstain from certain foods or from sexual relations for a time period in order to prepare for some important event. But this external consecration was always in the Old Testament only to be a symbol of what? The internal consecration and the internal cleansing that happens with God's people when they look at their own hearts and they say, I must break with the sin that is there. I must confess what is there. I must tell the Lord and agree with the Lord that what is in my heart is wrong. That those idols to which I cling, that the things that ensnare and engrip me, that they are wrong. That I must break with those things. I must confess them to the Lord. I must turn away from them in what the Bible calls repentance. If the people don't do this, they cannot go and live in the land of promise. You remember what we said in Joshua 1? What is the land all about? Remember? It's not only the promise of our future lives in the Lord that will be with Him in heaven forever. The land is also the symbol of the Lord's communion with us now, that we belong to Him now. You cannot have this communion with the Lord if you are harboring and holding on to the sin of your treacherous rebellion against God in your heart. You can't do it. You must break with it. You must say no to it. You must turn away from it by God's grace. Oh, He'll be the one that will prompt you to do even that, but you must do it if you are to enter into the land of communion with the Lord. For only that kind of break with sin will prepare you to be the people who can live and enjoy the Lord's presence and fellowship. The Lord brings Israel and us across the river in the face of our complete helplessness. And for this to happen, we must have the perspective of distance, we must have the preparation of consecration, and third, we must have, perhaps above all else, the presence of the Lord. The presence of the Lord is the only thing that helps in a helpless situation and enables a situation that is bad and getting worse to turn out for good. Joshua says to the people in verse 13, "Behold, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth." He heaps up the prepositional phrases to describe what the ark of presence is like. First of all, he says it's the ark of the covenant. The covenant is what God has done in binding us to Himself. The covenant is God's initiation of His promise that He will forever be our God and we will always be His people and that nothing or no one will ever separate us from Him. And He seals that covenant. As it were, He signs it. His signature is written in the blood of His Son. That's why the covenant promise of God that He will always be with us in all of our helplessness, across all the rivers of our life, that promise is most real to us as His people when in worship. When is it the most real? When we have communion together. Because it's in the communion meal, the covenant meal, where we're reminded, this is the cup of the new covenant. In my blood, Jesus says, do this as often as you drink of it in remembrance of me. As often as we take communion, we remember the unbreakable promise of the Lord sealed in His own Son's blood. And that's why in our church we're thinking a lot about communion these days and how much we should be celebrating it. Shouldn't we perhaps do it more? It's the Ark of the Covenant. God has bound Himself to you in the blood of His Son. Can anything shake God's grip on you if that's the cost it was to Him? If the covenant meant the blood of His Son, then will anything happen to cause God to just change His mind? I don't think so. Secondly, the Ark is the covenant of the Lord. And just quite simply there, when it says it's the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, it wants to underscore that He's the Lord and we're not. And we should stop devising our ways of getting out of our own situations on our own ingenuity. We should stop thinking about the pontoons that we want to build to go across the river. We should stop thinking about the bridges that we want to erect to get us across. We should wait for the Lord, who is the Lord, to define the way in which this is going to happen. And third, the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of all the earth, it says, of all the earth. He rules everything in heaven and on earth. And He does so for the good of those for whom His Son died. Jesus is the master of the wind and the waves. You know, it's interesting. The commentaries speculate about earthquakes. It's sometimes as if they can't just let it go that God's presence means He can do anything He wants to do. So they study the geological terrain and so forth, and they rightly come up with the fact, undoubtedly this is true, that the tectonic plates in Israel are in such a way that the river actually is in a very dangerous earthquake zone. And there are apparently records of earthquakes that have taken place, and the river has been stopped up or dammed up for a while as a result of the earthquake. But I would call to your attention simply this. There is no mention of secondary cause in Joshua chapter 3 at all. The Lord wants, by whatever means He may use, He wants the attention to be precisely on the fact that He did it and that His presence is the only reason to account for what happens here. It is the ark of the presence of the Lord of all the earth. And that is the only way that we can account for what goes on here. Over and over again, this chapter 3 puts the emphasis on what only God can do in the face of our utter helplessness. In verse 10, He is described as the living God. It is the living God who is among us. It is the living God who will do wonders among you, verse 5. It is the living God who passes over before the people, verse 11, who goes on ahead, who shows us the way, who is the way. It is when the ark of the presence, the ark of the covenant of the Lord of all the earth. It is when the presence of the Lord comes to the edge of the water that the water obeys Him and heaps up in a mighty wall, and the torrent is silenced and the water cut off. It is only in the presence of the Lord that the people can cross over on dry ground. So the Lord gives you perspective by which you must gaze at Him in the midst of your helplessness. The Lord calls us to prepare ourselves by breaking with sin, by confessing it, by distancing ourselves from it. And He provides His own presence as the only thing that will help us in a helpless situation. You know, it really must have been an amazing sight. The ark in the middle of the riverbed, and the people streaming by it on both sides, presumably. Gazing at it, watching it, knowing that it was the presence of the Lord and only the presence of the Lord that was saving them. And so it is in your life. Only the presence of the Lord can save you. Only if the Lord, if I may put it this way, shows up in Jesus Christ in your life will you be saved. Ultimately, from the treachery and tyranny and the torrent of your own heart, and temporally from all of the minor tributaries of torrents that swirl around our heart and life and distract us and cause us to lose our focus and lose our allegiance upon Him. All the nations passed over, it says in verse 17. Not one of the people of the nation of Israel failed to make it. Not one of the members of the covenant for whom Jesus Christ died will not make it across to the promised land. We are quite helpless, you and I. There is no way that we will survive the raging river unless the Lord makes a way on dry ground for us. There is only one way to get across the treachery and the barrier of sin. It is the way of the cross. It is the way of the one to whom the ark points.
It is the way of Jesus Christ. And there is only one Savior and only one pilot across the raging river. It is Him. Everything else will fail you. In the good old days of the Texas Rangers, when the Rangers used to guard the border in South Texas, it is said that when a ranger would need a professional recommendation and you really wanted to speak well of him, you would say of this Texas Ranger who had patrolled the river, "He'll ride the river with you." And that was about the best thing you could say about him. And that's about the best thing I can say about Jesus Christ. He will ride the river with you. He will show you the way. The way on dry ground. The way you can't make. The way in your helplessness you cannot provide. He will provide the way, for He is the way. So gaze upon Him. Have the perspective of your gaze that will never break. Prepare by cleansing your hearts and breaking with sin. And seek His presence and know His presence with you. And know that He is the one who will ride the river along with you. Jesus Christ is a friend to sinners. Jesus Christ is a helper to the helpless. Is He to you? Would you now receive Him again, even, as the one who is your Savior and your helper? And would you know Him to be the one who goes before you so that you may cross over on dry ground?